Oh yay, oh yay, oh yay. All persons having business before the Honorable, the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the United States and His Honorable Court. Be seated, please. Case number 09-3016, United States of America versus James Becton, also known as Funk, also known as P, also known as Pumpkin, appellant. Mr. LaCar for the appellant, Ms. Nyland for the appellee.
Good morning.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the court, I've reserved 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Fine.
And with the court's permission, essentially what I want to do in my limited time is focus on the necessity issue. Essentially, as we set forth in our opening and our reply brief, by September of 2005, when the application for wiretapping was first made, the government had a mosaic of information that wasn't disclosed to the district court. That, in fact, what they had, they could have easily have prosecuted Mr. Becton and his cohorts at that point in time. But what happened was they didn't tell Judge Colicatelli that they had twice as many informants as they claimed. They said they had three informants. Actually, they had six. There's a suggestion in the record there was a seventh. The informant's information went back almost a decade and talked and addressed alleged drug dealing with Mr. Becton, with his brother, Mr. Best, the so-called leaders of the conspiracy. The government did not disclose to Judge Colicatelli in September of 2005, for example, that they had almost twice the number of recorded buys that they set forth in their September 2005 application for wiretapping. Nor did they disclose, and I think this is pretty important, that they had the ability to do search warrants, and to execute search warrants, and the search warrants had, in fact, been useful, because a search warrant had been executed on the apartment of a woman named Christian Donaldson, who cooperated and testified in the case, and that recovered a significant amount of evidence that ultimately surfaced in the case.
Well, what about the affidavit's point that because of the manner in which the suspects were operating, namely inside a house and not speaking directly on their cell phones?
That's a valid argument. That's a valid question, Your Honor, and the answer to that is sort of comprehensive. Number one, I believe it was S3 had information as to Christian Donaldson's house being used as a stash house. Mm-hmm. They had the ability and, in fact, had videotape people out in the pits at that point in time. They certainly had the evidence. They had the ability to videotape. The fact that they didn't have they didn't actually have the ability to get inside the apartment. Let me make this suggestion to you. It's a bit of a red herring. And how do I say that? If you look at the proof of the pudding, what actually transpired at trial was that they used the transcripts of the wiretaps. They didn't use evidence of what was in the apartments. In fact, they had the ability to execute search warrants in the apartments. As I said, they had done so successfully with Ms. Donaldson in 2001. So they could have executed search warrants and gone ahead and prosecuted. But what happened was this case had been dormant for a number of years. And I think it was the district judge aptly observed, although he denied the motion to suppress, what he observed was that there was an indication that the government just wanted to jazz up the case. Because if you look at what they said we wanted information as to the sources. That's what they said. None of that surfaced at the trial. In fact, at the way the case ended up getting tried, there were approximately 138, 139 counts. 38 to 39 of those preceded the application for the wiretap.
So let me be clear. You're making, what, 2 points here, as I understand it. One is that given that the district court was advised of the failure to inform the judge who made the initial ruling of this information, there should have been a hearing.
That's right.
That's number one. Where does your second point go?
Well, as you pointed out, there are two. They should have had a Franks hearing, for one, because they didn't disclose the number. They didn't disclose the wealth of information.
Yeah.
The other point is, and that should have been conducted. Why didn't they disclose all that? What did they know? There's a fair indication that I tried to summarize in my reply brief of what the government really knew at that point in time. In addition to the failure to disclose all that they had as a justification for invading privacy rights, the other thing that they had the ability through conventional sources, that's the other argument, to advance the investigation. One, if they really wanted to advance the investigation, if what they were really looking to do, Judge Rogers, was to investigate, then they could have used informant. They had the informants. They had made a controlled buys in the summer of 2005 successfully.
Well, I understand your first point. I need to know where your second point is going. In other words, you say that the way the case was tried, you argue, shows that there was no need for the necessity element was not met here. That's your second point. I haven't seen the cases go in that direction. I just want to understand that.
I think if you look at the Blackmun case where they didn't disclose all that the informant really knew, that might help you probably more as to the first part.
That's right. That's the first point.
As to the second part, what one has to do, yes, you do. I think it's important to look at how they actually tried the case.
Yeah.
But as I summed up in the reply brief, after the government stated its position, they had a wealth of information. And the information that they had at that hand, at that point, suggests the following. They could have made better use of informants. They could have executed more search warrants. And they certainly could have done more controlled buys. It wouldn't have been too difficult to take people who are doing transactions right out in the pit and arrest them and turn them. Mm-hmm. That's what I'm trying to say. So it's important to look back. I think it's also important to understand what they had. It's one has to combine, sort of synthesize the facts that were at hand. So as I would suggest, the Gonzalez decision out of the Ninth Circuit and Mondragon out of the Tenth Circuit and Blackmun really tell us that what happened here was, as in words of Mr. Sussman below, the investigation really became the offense. That if what they were looking to do was to determine sources, which is what they told the judge, and to determine prices, well, they already knew prices, and as far as sources, there's no real indication in the record of any effort made to ascertain sources. They had plenty of information to prosecute these people. And what we look to in these cases is to analyze this question. Do they really need this information? Have the conventional methods failed?
Counsel, I think their main points, if I understand them correctly, the government will speak for itself, is that they were trying to find, in addition to what they could get by normal means, the manner in which the co-conspirators were redistributing large quantities of drugs, the identity of all members, and the manner in which the co-conspirators distributed the proceeds. And their suggestion was that could not be achieved by normal means.
And that's our position, is that's pretty standard language for these.
Well, but I think in the context of this case, it is not standard to the point of being meaningless. It's easy to comprehend in this kind of conspiracy what that means, and I don't know what your argument is to refute the legitimacy of those claims.
Okay, what I'm arguing is that they're saying this information, they're saying the stuff is being distributed in the pits. They certainly had the ability to videotape what was going on in the pits. They had people, they had a wealth of information as to their sources, as to where the buyers were being.
You were talking about the redistribution.
Sir?
The redistribution of drugs.
That's correct.
Yeah.
They had that. They also had
information. How did they have that? How did they have? How were they able to get that on the redistribution of drugs?
Well, what you're talking about is what the retail people do after that point in time, I suppose they certainly could have followed the retail purchasers and they could have turned them. That's what I'm suggesting. The redistribution, we're talking about street-level purchasers. If that's what they really wanted to do was tag the street-level people, then they certainly could have followed them. They could have arrested them and asked them who they're dealing with. But in terms of, what they said, what they told them.
I mean, your answer, it seems to me, to all of these suggestions is you grab some people you know who were involved and try and turn them.
That's part of the answer, Your Honor.
And that seems to me an unsatisfactory answer.
Well, I understand that.
Right. Well, so what else are you offering?
Well, what I'm offering.
That's all I'm hearing you saying is get some people in the conspiracy and turn them.
I'm offering the suggestion of using search warrants. I'm offering the suggestion
of search warrants aren't to get this information.
But search warrants.
This is on who is participating, the nature of redistribution, et cetera. That kind of search warrants aren't going to get that information.
And hadn't they used search warrants on at least three occasions?
I'm sorry?
I thought they had already tried to use search warrants and they hadn't been.
They used a search warrant of Christian Donaldson's apartment, and they got a photograph of her with Jim Becton that was used at trial. They found baggies and instrument and other indications, what we call tools of the trade. So they were not inefficacious at all. I see that I've used pretty much all of my time, so.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning. Suzanne Nyland for the United States. As this court has observed, there is not an exhaustion requirement in demonstrating necessity for a wiretap. That is to say, the government is not obliged to show that every single method that is available for an investigation of this type, a family-run drug conspiracy.
On the other hand, Congress has said that there is a requirement that it isn't standard operating procedure to have these wiretaps. And so you have the undercover people, you have search warrants, the investigation's been in a lull for a period of time. I guess I don't understand, in all these drug conspiracy cases, you have the same sort of set of facts. You have some undercover people, you have some search warrants, you have some pen registers, you have some video and audio taping. And does it follow that if you get an FBI affidavit saying we'd like more, that that's enough?
When the kind of detail that was provided here was set forth on all of those methods that the court has listed and others, yes, it is enough, because
What do we do with the evidence that the way this case was tried had nothing to do with the rationale for the tap?
Well, I don't know that I would agree with appellant's counsel's view on that, but I would note that so far I haven't seen any cases in which the court examines whether the warrant issued 2 or 3 years before trial was legitimate based on the hindsight of the evidence that actually went into the case as tried. And I would also note there were 16 people originally indicted here, 10 covered by the superseding indictment, and here we have in front of this court 1/16th or 1/10th of those pies. This is one appellant's appeal, and therefore we're just getting a small sliver of the evidence the government was attempting to and did develop in order to try to reach from the street level, as appellant's counsel has pointed to, all the way up to where the drugs were coming from, be it from North Carolina or from a supplier in Los Angeles, how the distribution was enforced and how people
were. So in effect, if the affidavit says we want to know the source, you've met the necessity requirement.
I don't think that would necessarily be a per se rule. I think
it sounds like it. That's all I'm getting at. I'm not saying it's not a legitimate rule, but it sounds like it, that if an affidavit says we want to know the source, and, you know, the undercover people aren't telling us the source, and the search warrant hasn't revealed the source, then we can tap.
I believe that essentially is true, because this was being investigated as a drug conspiracy, and to understand the full nature and scope of it, which is the phrase that we routinely return back to, what is the purpose for this tap? Why do we allow this intrusion? It's in order to get a hold of what the full nature and scope of it is, and the source is a key focus, but it is not the only focus. Appellant seems to argue alternatively that the government should have exhausted by repeating previous failed or very limited in terms of production methods.
I didn't hear him say exhaust, but it's the question of what did Congress have in mind in imposing this requirement. I mean, it always would be nice from the investigator's point of view to be able to have these recordings. There's no question about that.
It would, and this court observed in the Carter case that the necessity requirement is not meant to work as an impediment to making a good case better or a strong case airtight. If the government thought it had everything it needed and needed a bit more in order to get to the source, and that also filled in some of the holes as to some of the other 10 or 16 or more conspirators, there's nothing wrong with that.
So in drug conspiracy cases, it's almost an automatic rule.
I'm always reluctant to agree with something that.
Well, I'm trying to imagine a case when it wouldn't. I mean, I can't imagine that you couldn't find an agent who would say they want to know the source of the drugs.
But that agent's also obliged, as this agent did, to describe that, yes, search warrants have been tried. The fact that it may have turned up enough for one quid charge in someone's girlfriend's apartment, and a lot of these folks were moving the drugs around from one girlfriend's apartment to another, from one resident's apartment to another, as we detailed, demonstrates why that has limited effectiveness as a tool. There were some undercover buys, but as detailed in the affidavits. And they do cover the period in 2005 before the government came in and requested the first wiretap in September. There is a litany of opportunities where the government attempted to make undercover buys or worked with the informant known as S1 to try to make additional controlled buys. And these were met with mixed success. From time to time, the targets of this investigation, I'm thinking specifically of Mr. Mercer, the first target of a wiretap, would make a sale, and then he would start failing to return phone calls, or he'd say, oh, the price of crack is too high today, or here's someone else you can call, and it takes a few efforts to...
Do you know of any drug conspiracy case where there haven't been these taps?
I don't know, but I wouldn't know that for sure.
I'm just thinking about all the cases I've seen. There's always been a tap in these drug conspiracy cases.
And in this setting, that would make sense. I don't know... Well, no, I take that back. I have worked on cases where there were not wiretaps, where there was videotaped surveillance done, okay, either in a car or somewhere else. But the objective, depending on what the objective of the government's investigation is, I can't say definitively that at some point they could not have requested or couldn't have used wiretaps to get to the source. It's not hard to get videotapes or controlled buys of people on the street. It's very difficult, especially in a family-held business like this one, to be able to move up the chain and understand where the drugs are coming from and who's actually imposing control on that block of the city and saying it's mine.
As Judge Rogers has pointed out, you're just describing almost any drug conspiracy, right? They're all going to be close-knit. People are going to be furtive, and you're going to always have a need for the tap, right?
That's true, but not all of them necessarily swing as wide as this one does in terms of one family controlling one block and actually a couple of additional areas in the city. When someone has taken over an entire group of apartment buildings and a couple of parking lots, the Pit, the Second Court, and begun to build sort of a little bit of a mini empire and is dealing with people in other parts of the country to bring in a source, that may be a bit different from one enterprising drug dealer on one corner who may or may not be dealing with an enterprise that large and that sprawling, that one that becomes so powerful that it begins to take over the area and people are moving drugs around from place to place because perhaps there's not a lot of choice anymore once it's taken over by a group this powerful.
I wonder if this is another area where the war on drugs has sort of changed the law. You know, when the statute was originally enacted, we were in a very different world. In terms of using landlines as opposed to cell phones and things like that. I think the courts have acknowledged that. The Supreme Court has certainly said that courts have a limited role in telling the government how to try its case, much less investigate its case. Is that what you see happening in the law here?
I don't know that it would necessarily be a major change in this area. I would say, though,
I'm thinking back. Go back 30 years. I mean, putting taps on people's phones was a big deal.
And now people are using different devices. People are always one step ahead in innovating as the technology grows. Mm-hmm. So I don't know that wiretaps would be that effective down the road if something else comes along. It's hard to be tapping when they're constantly changing.
I was wondering
technology
about voice over IP. How would you tap that? Anyway, that's for another case. Okay.
Yeah, I'm sure we'll see that case someday. In any event, unless the court has any further questions about this, I would like to wrap up with the final point that...
Let me ask you, though, about the hearing.
Yes.
What is the burden? First, is there any requirement for a hearing? But second, if there is a requirement for a hearing, what kind of burden would a defendant have? I mean, here, there was a pretty fulsome burden. Fulsome proffer.
There wasn't. I guess his complaint is it wasn't more fulsome. But my answer back to that, and to the court's question, is this. His burden in order to get a Franks hearing was to show there was a false statement in the affidavit, in this case from Agent Counts, which he is stating are omissions that he thinks should have been present concerning the existence of more informants and more about what they knew and more about the particular details of the criminal backgrounds of two of them. But it's not enough to show, even if one could accept that as a false statement, which I would argue against, there are two additional prongs he had to show and didn't below. One is that any omission or so-called false statement was made deliberately or recklessly in some degree of scienter, which they never attempted to prove here and which they are obliged to come in and make some showing of before they can get a hearing.
Well,
and finally,
it's sort of the facts speak for themselves. The government knew they had six undercover agents. They only told the court about three. I mean, that's about as far as anybody can go other than sort of a smoking gun type. You know, you have a tape of the FBI agent saying, I'm going to hide this from the court.
But I would disagree with that reading of this very strongly for the following reason. Those three additional informants appear in the third and final affidavit that is directed at Mr. Willie Best, who is sort of the highest ranking person of the three that were the targets here. I think a fair reading of this affidavit is these three folks knew something about him, and that made them more relevant to the affidavit to tap his phone. They were more peripheral and perhaps not very much relevant at all to the first two taps.
In your brief, that the explanation is that the affidavit was focusing on a target and therefore only mentioned the relevant parties.
Well, that's one explanation. And the other question, though, really is, how much of a data dump must one do into these affidavits for the court to be able to evaluate fairly that the government has made its showing, and yet not to be confronted with the claim that if you left out one small piece of information that looks very important in the trial 3 years later, which this did not.
Twice, you left out 50% of what you had is the argument.
It wasn't 50% of the content.
Well, I mean, but it's...
I mean, when we look at how valuable S1 is, S2 to S6 are all incarcerated. I think there's maybe two paragraphs of what S2 knows. In any event, even if one were to say, I'm going to infer, which I don't believe they can, they need to do more than make that showing in order to meet the scienter requirement. They have a third showing they had to make, which they've never attempted to do, which is if one excises that information out, is there still probable cause supporting the issuance of a warrant? And they can't make that showing because the warrant is so fulsome, the affidavits are so fulsome and detailed on that point. And so because appellant cannot demonstrate an abuse of discretion here in the district court's ruling, we ask for an affirmance. Thank you.
Okay, I had one other question. Let's see, the government agrees about the rebuttal closing argument, I gather. The district court on rehearing, I mean at the motion for the new trial, acknowledged it was error to allow that.
We agree with the district court that it was error because we were not able to put into evidence the factual basis, the evidentiary basis for the fact that he was in prison between 1995 and 1999.
But the case had closed. I mean, we were at oral closing arguments.
Right. And
it's too late to put in evidence.
We agree with the district court at the end of the day that it was error.
All right.
But we think it important to know the context in which the statement was made and the district court's very important findings that rebut any notion that this was a substantial prejudice type of error that would warrant reversal.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. I don't suggest, Judge Rogers, that they had to exhaust every conceivable means. What I suggest, however, is that if one looks back at the circuit's precedents in Carter and Savuomo, where they investigated people for 14, 18 months. They went to Africa, for example, in one of those cases to pursue leads, that there was certainly ample time to investigate the case, if that's really what they wanted to do. I think what we made clear, but what they really wanted to do here, our position is get wiretaps, authorization wiretaps, so they'd have evidence, because perhaps they had some subliminal concerns with the six cooperators that they had, and of all the take buys. I mean, at some point, apropos of the war on drugs, somebody, I think, has got to sit back, and there are three people here who are in a position to do that, to say, wait a minute, we always want more. The government always wants more. Sometimes the defendant always wants less, but the fact of the matter is there's got to be a balance struck. And in this particular case, the government just went beyond the pale. It didn't need this information. If you're going to give them the awesome power to intrude on people's telephone calls, then they really have to make a good faith showing. They've got to make, and they've got to make a disclosure to the district judge of what they've got. And that's just not what they did here.
All right. Thank you, counsel. You were appointed, and whether you prevail or not, I enjoyed reading your briefs. Thought they were excellent.
Always a pleasure.
The government, too. Thank you very much for your service to the court.
Thank you.